from the nation's capital. This is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, a very interesting, important show. Violence directed towards offenders, how it affects their behavior. We have Janine Zweig. She is a senior fellow with the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute, where her work addresses issues related to violent victimization, primarily intimate partner and sexual violence. I'm going to read briefly from a new study that Janine is responsible for. It indicates that adult men and women who are physically assaulted or threatened with assault while in prison have negative emotional reactions to such experiences, which can increase the likelihood of negative behaviors after release and have a detrimental consequence for their long-term mental health and well-being. Specifically, in prison victimization leads to hostility once prisoners are released to the community, and this hostility in part leads to further criminal behavior, including violent behavior and mental health problems. Janine, welcome to D.C. Public Safety.
Thank you for having me.
Janine, this is an important piece of research because a lot of us don't understand all of the implications of victimization while in prison. The violence that is directed, the violence that is witnessed regarding inmates while incarcerated does have an impact upon their behavior upon release, correct?
Correct, it does. And these consequences make their reentry transition a little bit different for those who may not have experienced those kinds of victimization incidents when they were inside.
Now, give me a sense of your studies. You took a look. There's a couple studies here that are in play. One is taking a look at violence in prison. One is taking a look at violence before prison.
The other was looking at violence for a population on community supervision, so those who were diverted from incarceration.
Okay.
So both cases.
But tell me, let's go back in terms of the folks who were in prison and how it affected their behavior. Give me a sense as to the study and the results.
Okay, great. Well, this was a study, a sub-study of the Serious and Violent Offender Reentry Initiative, which was a major evaluation of reentry programming funded by the Department of Justice. And we looked at a sample who completed surveys 30 days before their release from the facility, mm-hmm. 3 months after their release, 9 months after their release, and again, 15 months after their release. So we have four different time points that we spoke with these individuals, and we found that among that population, about 53% reported that they had experienced either a physical assault while they were inside or the threat of a physical assault. And these numbers are a little bit higher than what has been found in other studies. For example, Wolf and colleagues did a study of 14 prisons and found that about 20% of females and 25% of males reported physical assaults by another inmate. Mm-hmm. And there's also around about 30% of males and just under 10% of females reported assaults that were staff on inmate assaults. So our study found a little bit higher prevalence rates, likely because we also included the threat of physical assault in our measure.
Now, so give me a sense as to what that means. I mean, if your study indicated higher rates of assault or threats of assault, other studies just looked at assault. So when you include threats, what you're saying is that according to your research, it was twice as high.
That's right, because threats are more common, and then the Wolf study was looking at actual violence experiences toward the individual.
Now, the serious violent offender research was done several years ago, correct?
Yes, we conducted that study. Interviews that were still, while the person was incarcerated, were conducted between July of 2004 through November of 2005. And then the follow-on interviews came after that, as I said.
So you went back and re-interviewed the individuals involved?
That's right. We interviewed, these were individuals across various programs in 12 different states, and we found individuals first while they were incarcerated and interviewed them 30 days before their release from prison, and then a series of follow-up interviews conducted at 3, 9, and 15 months post their release. Mm-hmm. So we're really able to look at pre-existing in prison experiences and then their reentry experiences at three different time points.
Recidivism rates were rather high. Am I correct on that? And it took the five-year point when they went back and took another look. There were some reductions for some groups, but all in all, the rates of recidivism, if memory serves me correctly, for this particular population were rather high.
Correct. And that is true across many who are incarcerated, that two-thirds are recidivate within a number of years. In this particular sample, we were looking specifically at the role of victimization in other consequences and how that relates to their recidivism behavior, as well as their substance use relapse. Mm-hmm. So we looked at both types of outcomes related to their reentry back into the community.
Okay. So you went back and took a look, interviewed these individuals, and talked to them about their in-prison experiences. And from that, you found out that when you include the threat of assault, it's high, that violence seems to be an integral part of prison life.
Correct.
And that has detrimental consequences upon release.
That's right. So what we did was we felt there was a real gap in knowledge of what does it mean that these violence experiences are happening for people who are incarcerated? What does that mean for them once they've come back to the community? And what we did was we relied on a theory called general strain theory, which really tries to identify the steps toward delinquency. And the idea behind that is that there's experiences that are considered noxious strains or, you know, for a better term, maybe harmful or unpleasant experiences that happen to people that relate to feelings about those behaviors, which then in turn contribute to behavioral outcomes. And so the presence of a negative or noxious strain like victimization is predicted to create negative states of emotions. And those are particularly negative experiences for a number of reasons. For example, victimization experiences are often seen as unjust. They have a large emotional impact, and individuals have less personal control in that situation. And so these are considered particularly noxious strains that people are exposed to. So when you have a negative feeling in reaction to something, this can be either an externalized feeling, so for example, anger, hostility, or frustration, or it can be an inner-directed feeling, such as depression or anxiety. And the idea behind this theory is that once you have those feelings, you have a behavioral reaction in relation to that feeling. So an externalized behavioral reaction related to the outer-directed negative feeling. So to put that more simply, if you're experiencing anger or hostility in reaction to an experience that you've had, you may commit violence or delinquency. If you're experiencing an internal behavioral reaction to depression or anxiety, then you might turn to substance use or that kind of thing. So that's the idea behind this, and we thought this theory might help explain some of the reaction to these in-prison victimization experiences.
Well, it talks about the detrimental impact of going to prison, what that means to individuals, what it means to their own mental states, what it means to their own emotional states. So in essence, what you're saying is that because of that exposure to violence, that sense that that's happening in prison, that they're having a harder time dealing with the realities of coming out. They're having a harder time dealing with life on the outside because they're bringing all of these pent-up emotional feelings, the sense of hostility towards their own environment, that transfers out into the community?
That's right. So in both of these cases, looking at both criminal behavior, including violent reoffending, and then relapse to substance use, we found that the in-prison victimization experiences did play a role. And it was a partial role, but it's a role nonetheless, and it's important to make those links. So these physical assault experiences or the threat of physical assault led to feelings of anger and hostility. And as you said, you bring those feelings of anger and hostility back into the community when you return. And those feelings, what we call mediated the relationship to criminal behavior and violence. So in other words, they contributed to their participation in criminal behavior and violent reoffending. And this is, you know, above and beyond the other kinds of things we think contribute to recidivism. So, for example, in these statistical models, we included other kinds of things that contribute to recidivism behavior. So, you know, a person's long-term criminal history is predictive of what they're going to do upon reentry.
Mm-hmm.
Their ability to get employment, their family support, these kinds of other things are all work together to contribute to someone's likelihood that they're going to recidivate. And so what we did was we accounted for all those other things and then looked at, okay, on top of all that, how does this prison victimization experience contribute to these feelings and then later to their behavior? And we still found that, yes, indeed, these victimization experiences matter for their likelihood of recidivating and violent reoffenses.
What about before prison? Because the practitioners are going to say that many of the individuals that they have interviewed, many of the individuals that they have focused on, say, in parole and probation in the community setting, they talk about instances while in prison, but they also talk about instances while outside of prison. I've had a variety of female offenders before these microphones who routinely tell me that they were subject to sexual victimization before they even entered the criminal justice system. So there's that component of it as well, correct?
Absolutely. And I will say that, you know, the likelihood that the victimization experiences and offender behaviors are deeply connected, and there's lots of research that shows that people who commit criminal behaviors often have had damaging and traumatic experiences happen to them through their own victimization, and that's very important to keep in mind. So we did actually try to account for pre-prison victimization experiences as well. Now, we did not measure sexual victimization, to be clear on that, in this particular study. In the other study, we did. But in this particular study, we only measured physical assault. And we did, that was one of the other things we accounted for in our models to be able to say, okay, taking all of this into account, does the in-prison victimization experiences matter? And yes, we still found those relationships. And I'm saying this in terms of the reoffending behavior, but in terms of relapse to substance use, which obviously plays a critical role in someone's likelihood of reoffending, but also many, many offenders also struggle with substance use issues, we found that those in-prison victimization experiences increase the likelihood of substance use, but through the feelings of depression. So for people who had an emotional reaction that was in line with depression versus anger and hostility, that depression led to a greater likelihood of relapse to substance use.
So the bottom line is, whether it happens in prison or whether it happens in the community, but your research took a look at the prison experience. If you have a person who has been constantly victimized, exposed to violence, whether it be in their own neighborhoods, whether it be their own families, whether it be their own friends, whether it be while in prison, by the time we get them in parole and probation, it's a real challenge in terms of dealing with a long history of violence, exposure to violence, perceptions of violence. And so then they come to us, and we have to deal with them as individuals, oftentimes through cognitive behavioral therapy, through mental health interventions, and through substance abuse interventions. Well, we note that our population, and I think it's fairly common, 80% have histories of substance abuse. We're finding that mental health problems are increasing and seem to be increasing dramatically within the populations that we both supervise and serve. So it's becoming a real conundrum in terms of what to do with individuals who have such a long history of exposure to violence, correct?
I think that's correct. And I think that one of the findings that you find across various literatures, for example, you find it in the substance abuse treatment literature, that if trauma is left unaddressed, then someone may not be able to get all the benefits that treatment might provide them. And so it might be misinterpreted as being resistant to treatment when really this person has larger issues around victimization experiences and trauma that have been left unaddressed in that treatment scenario. I think we could learn from that in this context context as well. So if someone seems to be resisting changing from a life of criminal behavior or, you know, these kinds of things, there's so many things contributing to that behavior. But one that might be left unaddressed by supervision agencies might be this person's own experiences with victimization and then the trauma that they have as a result of those experiences and addressing that trauma in an appropriate way. Certainly in, for example, you brought up sexual assault. In the sexual assault world, it is, you know, widely believed that specific trauma-informed care for sexual assault survivors is really key to helping them move past those experiences. And that's not, you know, a typical therapy. I use that word a little bit loosely, but it's a particular kind of therapy. And that kind of offering, you know, it's not clear the extent to which that's being addressed in supervision agencies.
Well, I'm going to reintroduce, I guess, Janine Zweig. She is a senior fellow with the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. The particular piece of research that Janine is responsible for is for prisoners who face violence reentry as a challenge. That is the sort of the show today, dealing with individuals who have a history of violence, whether it be in prison, whether it be in the community. And so it becomes a lesson for those of us in community supervision and for the larger population. Janine, somebody once suggested that the people that we deal with on community supervision, and again, I'm with the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. We are a federal parole and probation agency serving Washington, D.C. In many cases, I'm told by our parole and probation agents and I've told by therapists that some of the individuals who we deal with under supervision almost are like war victims. The level of violence, the level of trauma in the community, in the prison, by the time they get to us, they are in many cases traumatized individuals who have a very difficult time expressing who they are and what they are because, quite frankly, they're not sure. A very large distrust of the criminal justice system, a very large distrust of and profound distrust of the treatment process. Am I in the ballpark?
Yeah, I think that sounds like what we've found here. Although we didn't measure post-traumatic stress disorders specifically, we do know that victims of physical and sexual violence from the literature do display symptoms of PTSD, and that would be analogous to what someone who has experienced war would experience.
So what does it mean to us in terms of community supervision? What does it mean in terms of the incarcerative process? How do we deal with this? Because of the recidivism rates, generally speaking, are described as 2/3 rearrested, 1/2 reincarcerated after 3 years. You get different measurements from different studies based upon the length of the study. But basically, the rate of recontact with the criminal justice system is high, and this could be part of the underlying structure as to why it is as high as it is.
I think that is true. I think that, you know, when trauma is left unaddressed, that it leads to health-compromising and life-compromising behaviors like reoffending, like violent reoffending, and things like substance use and substance abuse. And so if a person has these experiences that have caused trauma in their lives that they have never addressed, their well-being is damaged and their ability to move forward is potentially damaged as well. And it isn't clear to me the extent to which community supervision agencies actually, you know, assess for victimization experiences, whether it be in prison or in the community. As you noted, we have another study with a community supervision population who are diverted from incarceration, and similar patterns apply here, that victimization is related to recidivism and substance use in
that population as well. Tell me about that.
Sure. Well, this was an evaluation of a drug court program, and we asked questions related to victimization in the year prior to their participation in our study, and so it was a focus was on the drug court population, but our comparison sample were also individuals who were on probation and under other community supervision functions. And so it was a community-based sample of offenders where we looked at their physical and sexual victimization and then applied the same theoretical premises we talked about before to look at, you know, what was their emotional reaction in terms of depression, anxiety, and hostility, and then also what was their likelihood of recidivating and relapse into substance use. And we found that the same patterns apply in terms of substance use, that the feelings around depression, a victimization experience led to depression, which then led to substance use relapse. And then we found a more direct relationship with recidivism, and that is the victimization led to recidivism behaviors. And again, this is taking into account all kinds of other aspects of their lives going on at that same time to try to say, does this victimization matter beyond other things that might contribute to recidivism? And so I think there is some idea behind the idea that when you leave a trauma unaddressed, that it can lead to offending and violent offending. And that's an important, you know, it does matter for their long-term consequences.
What is the principal modality in terms of dealing with the history of violence? What can we do in community supervision, parole and probation agencies, community-based agencies? How can we meaningfully intervene in the lives of people who have come from violent backgrounds?
I think that when community agencies focus on victimization, they typically mean the victim of the crime of the person they're speaking with. So the person under supervision, who was the victim of their crime. But I don't think there's much focus on assessing the offender themselves, the supervisee themselves, for their own victimization experience. So I think the first step is identifying the extent to which this is, you know, that their probationers or parolees report these experiences. And if they're reported, then programming and referral beyond there. But the first step would be, what kinds of assessments are happening in these agencies to even identify who among their population might need help with dealing with traumatic victimization experiences of their own?
Will they tell us?
I think that in our experience, they do talk about their victimization experiences. They might not describe it in... I think there is best practices around how you ask about victimization experiences. And mm-hmm. So in other words, instead of saying, are you a victim? Have you ever been a victim of domestic violence? Have you ever been raped? There is best practice that shows when you label the kinds of victimization, people are less inclined to tell you, yes, they are a victim of that. But if you say, for example, has your partner ever held you down so you couldn't leave and forced you to have sex, or has someone slapped, kicked, or hit you, people are more inclined to ask those behaviorally focused questions versus questions that label them as a victim. And you could then assess from there if they're saying, yes, I've had those kinds of experiences more deeply. Are those experiences recurring? Are they with their partners or not, and then addressing follow-up referrals and treatments that might make sense for the particular kinds of violence that they're experiencing.
And so once we find out about that background, once we've established that background, what do we do with that individual? Considering the context and the research saying that the vast majority of people, just for substance abuse, very few people within the incarcerative setting, very few people in parole and probation or who are on parole and probation get treatment for substance abuse issues. Very few get treatment for mental health issues. This sounds like it goes way beyond that. It connects to it all. All of this behavior is interconnected. There's no such thing as just a substance abuse problem, just a mental health problem, just a violence problem. Somehow, some way, as you just said, we have to assess that individual, and then we have to meaningfully intervene within the context of a system that is short on resources and having caseloads that are skyrocketing. What can we do to meaningfully intervene in the life of an individual who has such a profound exposure to violence?
I think perhaps it might be about doing better matches between what the person's needs are and the treatment that's being offered. If there are limited resources for treatment, just sending everyone who assesses for a substance use issue, for example, to the same treatment is a one-size-fits-all kind of characterization that might not work for everyone because, for example, those who are dealing with the trauma of victimization by using substances, that person needs a different kind of care, what we would say is trauma-informed care, than someone who doesn't have that background. And so maybe a better targeting and matching of particular individuals to the limited resources and treatments that you're able to refer to as one way of trying to use the limited resources more wisely.
We at the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency believe in a group process, and I've sat in on a variety of groups, violence reduction groups and groups for women. This is not an easy process. Getting people to talk about what they've been through, what they've experienced, is profoundly difficult, and getting the answers, and you have to have a lot of trust in the person running the group, and you've got have to have a lot of trust in your group members to be able to share at this level, and sometimes that takes weeks or months of effort to get that person to finally feel free enough to admit to everything that's happened to him or her. I mean, this is a profoundly moving experience in their lives, and this is something that they carry with them for the rest of their lives. Whether it happened in the community or whether it happened in prison, it's not easy to talk about this stuff.
That is surely the case, and I do think that finding the right treatments and methodologies for caring for these individuals is beyond the scope of what we studied here. But what we could say is that better targeting might be one step toward it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also say that in terms of partnering with local agencies that have expertise in some of these areas. So, for example, one of the pushes under the Prison Rape Elimination Act standards is around partnering with local agencies that have expertise in treating survivors of sexual assault. So if the in-prison experience is a sexual victimization, or even in the community if it's a sexual victimization and that's what you discover is the issue at hand, then not necessarily relying on your own means to address that, but partnering with agencies that's what they specialize in, is helping individuals who've had that kind of experience deal with it and move beyond it. And so tapping into other community resources and expertise that you wouldn't necessarily expect a supervision agency to have.
The bottom line behind all of this, and we only have a minute left in the program, the bottom line behind all of this is that we within the criminal justice system need to understand that the people that we deal with, and we're experiencing rather high rates of recidivism throughout the United States, that we need to understand that individuals who come to us are oftentimes traumatized by their own experiences while in the community, while in prison. Prison certainly doesn't help in many cases in terms of furthering that victimization, that sense of trauma. And we have to understand that as a bottom line construct if we're going to have a shot at helping these people overcome their difficulties, get off of drugs, deal with mental health issues, deal with anger issues, and reintegrate successfully, correct?
I agree. I think that we often don't think about offenders as victims, but their victimization experiences matter as well.
But that's the interesting thing, because in our life, we see people caught up in the criminal justice system as victims all the time. Because, again, we're the ones who go through that experience with them in the group setting and what happens to them. I mean, to talk to a woman who, and it's very common for women to be sexually victimized while by family members, by people who they know, before they even got into the prison setting. And the same thing in some cases happens to men, but just violent victimization. These are often traumatized individuals. Like I said before, they're almost like people have described them as being victims of war.
Right. Right. And that victimization likely played a hand in their criminal behavior and offending to begin with.
Well, we've had Janine Zweig, ladies and gentlemen, a senior fellow at the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute, talking about the show title today, Violence Directed Towards Offenders, How It Affects Their Behavior. I really want to express my profound appreciation for Janine and the Urban Institute for taking something like this on, because we within the criminal justice system must come to grips with the people who we have under our supervision if we ever hope to reduce the rate of recidivism. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. We appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have themselves a very pleasant day.